Accession number 8667, rule number 5.
Mr. Boughton, reel 5. Did you spend that first night in the dugout?
Oh, yes. They were all very, very primitive sort of things. They were just a hole with some corrugated iron stretched across part of it, where we get the front part of our body underneath the iron, and our legs were out in the open. But anyway, we got some rest during the night. There was some gunfire, but nothing to worry us. And then we had a fair rest. And I think somebody brought us round some dixies of tea in the morning, as far as I can remember. And then we were taken, handed over to some of the troops who'd been on there all the time. I think they were the Worcesters and Gloucesters and Hampshires. I think they were the regiments and chaps who'd served in India, of real hardened troops, and they took us up to the front line to give us the lay of the land. I'm afraid they hadn't got a very good opinion of our battalion, because after all, a lot of them were only youngsters, 19 and 20, and they'd never had any military experience at all, except what we'd had in Malta, which had been rushed through. But these other men were seasoned regular troops who had seen service in India, and naturally they didn't think very much of our London battalion. And matter of fact, there was so much illness and illness and sickness amongst them, I think they used to call it the Go Sick Battalion. But anyway, those who were left were very good fellows who managed to get through it and got some stamina. But there certainly was a great deal of sickness, chiefly dysentery and things like that. But anyway, they took us up to the front line, and we went through narrow trenches and then got up to the front line and told us, you know, keep your head down, be careful, mind the wire and all the instructions. And then when we eventually get to the front line, we were able to peep out and get the lay of the land. And there was quite a wide space between our front line and the Turkish front line, and in the distance we could see three rows of what looked like bundles of old clothes laying out in the open. And after asking what they were, they told us that when the attack was made on Suvla Bay, the 88th Brigade had to make a diversionary attack on Cape Ellice to keep the Turks' mind off Suvla Bay. But it was a very exposed position, and as the troops went over in three lines, they were mowed down by machine gun fire from the Turks, and casualties were very heavy. And it was such an exposed position that nobody could ever get out and recover the bodies or bury the remains, and these were the mounds that we could see in the distance. Well, after that, again, we had to start preparing for another evacuation. And again, it was a case of so many men going off each night and destroying anything that was useful, any positions that could be used for an attack against us, and any stores or anything, destroying everything that would be any use at all to the Turks.
Were you there to assist with the evacuation then?
Oh yes, that's what our job was, really, you see. Everybody had to tuck in and do something. Chiefly it was opening up stores, opening up case anything that was on the beach, and destroying anything that was useful. There were some mules on there. Of course, there was no chance of getting the mules off, so they were simply shot and thrown in the sea. But
What was morale like on Cape Hatteras this time?
Well, there was a great feeling of relief that we were eventually going to get off, and the morale was all right because you were trained soldiers and you did your duty, what you were told to do. But our only hope was that we would get off safely. But there was a great fear that we wouldn't, that there would be a final attack, and that would be the finish of us, either killed or taken prisoner. Fortunately, it didn't happen that way, but that was at the back of your mind all the time. And England, being about 3,000 miles away, very few of us thought we would ever see it again. But we did.
What was fighting like at this time?
Oh, fighting was very slack. I think, as I said before, the Turks were just as fed up with fighting as what we were, really. And I think they were short of men, and we certainly were short of men. There was no hopes of us making a successful conclusion of the campaign. All we were concerned with was hanging on. But we weren't doing any fighting. It wasn't absolutely necessary just to defend ourselves. But I say those last few weeks were really taken up with destroying stores, ammunition, and advising the chaps what to do on the nights of the evacuation. And each night, so many. And the only way to get off was going, as I say, going through the old River Clyde again. They had to go up the staircase, through the bowels of this ship, and down the other side, and then taken off to destroyers in the bay, to destroyers again. But so it wasn't very easy to get off.
But would you have to do this in silence?
Oh, yes. We didn't have to make too much noise. Although, I say, we were, less than 2 miles inland. But nevertheless, we didn't want the Turks to observe too much activity at all. And I say most of it was done at night. But I think I was telling you about Asiatic Annie, the gun that fired the shell over. She used to come over at regular intervals, and you could hear this thing coming. As soon as the horn went, you would wait these so many seconds, I'm not sure how many, 6 or 7, and she would land on the beach. But on one day, I remember it falling into a great pile of cheese that had just been landed. We hadn't long had a cheese ration. I think Sir Ian Hamilton got that for us. And this lot had been landed on the beach, and this shell fell right in the lot. And you never saw such a mess in all your life. There was cheese scattered all over the place. Uneatable, of course, so we lost our ration. But food was getting a bit more plentiful. There'd been such a row about the bad food that it was more plentiful. But there was no facilities for cooking it except on open fires, when you could get a fire. But most of it had to be cold stuff, or uncooked stuff, or something that could be heated up very quickly. No, there were no mess huts or tents where you could go in and have your meal in comfort.
Was the weather improving?
The weather was very cold. We didn't have another deluge like we did on Suvla Bay, but it was very, very cold. We used to wear anything we could get hold of, any discarded old coats or jumpers from somebody else had left off, or casualties, we used to put on until we had half a dozen thicknesses of clothes on very often, just to keep warm. I don't know how we survived, but we did. Surprising what you can put up with when you have to.
How long were you on Cape Hatteras before you left, finally?
I don't know, you've got the date, darling, somewhere. I think it was about... I think it was about December 23rd. I think it was 2 to 3 weeks. I think. Without turning up my dates. I believe we were on there 2 or 3 weeks.
And where did you go when you finally came off?
When we came... when we finally came off, again we were taken off by these motorised barges, and again we had to find a boat somewhere laying off the coast. I can't think what boat that was, and again I'm thinking back and I can't remember whether she took us to Mudros or straight off to Alexandria. I've an idea she took us, I think she took us to Mudros, and we must have transferred to a larger boat that took us to Alexandria, I think. That is a bit vague, but again, we came off safely, and I believe everybody, I don't think there was any casualties in the evacuation, and I'm sure nobody was left behind. They said not anyway. And again, of course, as we came off, you could see all the fires starting, with all the stores being satellite and ammunition exploding. And that was the final view of the Cape Ellice campaign, to see that lot go west. But I think we went to Mudros that night, and then I think in the morning we were transferred to a larger boat, I'm pretty sure. And then we were taken back to Alexandria. I think we must have been. But again, I say that when we got onto these boats, the Navy and everybody else was all very kind to us and very good to us, and treated us as heroes and looked after us as well as they could. But as you can imagine, the relief at getting off that blasted peninsula was something to be believed.
What did you do in Alexandria?
When we got to Alexandria, there was a makeshift camp there, I think it was called Sidi Bish, and all intents, of course, and we were all paraded there. There was all sorts of detachments, and we were sorted out, and again I think we were issued with some pay. And I believe there we got some fresh clothing too. And I think, I'm pretty sure, that we were united with our kit bags. We'd left our kit bags behind in Alexandria when we were on the way up to Gallipoli. Of course, we never expected to see those again, but they had still got them in stock somewhere, and they were reissued to us, to those who survived. How it was done, I can't remember, but I know we got our kit bags back. And we also got some back pay. And I remember one morning a chap coming up to me and saying, there's a strange sergeant, he says, looking for you. And I said, a sergeant? He said, yes. I said, where from? He said, I don't know. Anyway, eventually this sergeant turned up, and he was a very old friend of my family, apparently a great friend of my brother's, and he was in the pay corps, I believe, stationed in Alexandria, and he'd seen the list of troops that had been taken off Gallipoli, and he knew that I was out there, and looking down the list he found my name, and he'd been asking round the camps until he eventually found me, which was a very great surprise, of course. And he was able to write home and tell my family that I was still alive and well. But it was a wonderful chance meeting. Well, afterwards, when we got sorted out, our little remnant, I believe a few of the chaps who'd been evacuated from Cape Ellice and sent to Alexandria in hospital and one thing or another, rejoined us, until I think we were 200 or 300 strong. And we were then taken in open trucks on the railway from Alexandria right up to a little camp out in the desert called Wardan. There was only a very tiny little village there, of Bedouins, but this place was nothing else but desert all the way around us. But they had laid a water pipeline, so we didn't have to bother about water. Well, the journey up in these cattle trucks was an absolute nightmare, because we had to climb up into these trucks, and with the chaps being very weak and still suffering from dysentery, they had a job to get in and out. And every so often, and the train driver had to stop in the middle of the desert, and the chaps would climb out of the trucks and attend to the calls of nature all out in the desert. This occurred several times on our way up to this camp. But anyway, we got there eventually, and tents were dumped off this train, and we had to erect them, and which we did rather hastily and hurriedly, to get some cover for the night. And I think a guard was mounted, and we just turned in. We only had some iron rations again, and then we were told that things would be sorted out in the morning, which they were. And then, when morning came, we had to rearrange all the camp and get it in proper order and proper lines, and then the great clean up and sort out started. Fortunately, having a supply of water, we were able to have washdowns and clean ups and washed some of our clothes. It was all in cold water, mine, but anyway, it was something to be able to have a damn good wash. But and after two or three days, a small naffy hut turned up from somewhere. I suppose it was sent up from Alexandria or from Cairo. I think it came from Cairo, but it was quite well stocked, and with the money that we'd been issued with, again, we were able to buy all sorts of what were luxuries to us, tin milk and tin fruit and cigarettes and things like that, unheard of things. So life began to take on a little better outlook. But it was clouded soon afterwards by the arrival of a new commander of our little remnant. Major Nathan, I think, was away ill or wounded. Anyway, this chappie came out, Lieutenant Colonel Kinnard. He'd come from a guards battalion. I don't think he'd heard any shots fired in anger, but he took command of our little lot, and really, he treated us well, in a very, very shabby way indeed. We had to line up the tents, and then in the morning we'd have the sand all absolutely level, so we had to get ground sheets and pile kit bags on them and drag them up and down to get the sand all level, so that there shouldn't be any footmarks. Then he would go into the tents, and he would dig around with his cane to see if he could find any matches or cigarette ends. And if he did, the whole lot would be put on a charge and have to do defaulters drill for an hour in the evening with full pack on. Oh, he was a proper Tartar, and quite a wonder he didn't get shot in the back. He really was out of this world.
What was your relationship like with other officers?
Oh, the other officers, they were good. Yes, they were very, very good. One officer in particular, Lieutenant G to G Barkus, Barkus. He'd only just joined us when we started preparing for the evacuation, but he was a young man, just my age, and although I was only private, we got quite very friendly, and his fellow officer, Lieutenant Dickinson, he was killed in France, unfortunately. I used to look after them, after these two officers. They appointed me their officer's servant, which I didn't wish to be, but anyway, they said I had to be. And they treated me very well indeed, and I got very friendly with Lieutenant Barkas, well, right the way through until a few years ago.
How long was Lieutenant Colonel Kennard with you?
Lieutenant Colonel Kennard, he stayed with us until it was only a few weeks or so. I forget. No, again, I haven't got the dates with me. It wasn't many weeks, but anyhow, he made himself a damn nuisance in all the time that he was there, and he treated us like dirt. He wanted to know why the men hadn't had haircuts. Why hadn't they cleaned their buttons? We told him we'd got no money and we had no base or anything else, and he said, "Oh, there's plenty of sand in the desert. Use that." But he really was a tartar, and we used to have large tin bowls where we used to fill them up with water and stand in them and scrub ourselves to try and get rid of these blooming lice and bites and one thing or another. And if he passed by while we were doing it, we all had to stand to attention while he passed by in a bitter cold wind and sand whizzing around her in the desert. That was one of his funny little habits.
What were your duties while you were in the desert?
The duties there, well, chiefly it was for chasing the Sanasi Arabs. They were making themselves a blooming nuisance, cutting communications and damaging the railway that ran to Suez, I think. Not ran along to Suez somewhere. But anyway, there was only small bodies of them. They weren't a terrible danger, but as soon as you got near them, they used to disappear like the wind. But we had to go out at night and take patrols and try and run across them. And if you did, you'd fire a few shots and they'd be off. There was no hard fighting or anything again in that. It was just a question of patrolling and scaring them off.
Did you ever capture any?
No, I don't think we did. No, I don't think we... Oh, I think, yes, we did. We did, but they captured one small convoy, and I remember they got a load of dates. There was only, perhaps a dozen of them, and camels. Yes, we did capture, that's right. And they got these dates, which we confiscated, and so we had dates added to our ration for a few days. But that was the only ones that we did capture.
Did these Arabs approach the camp?
Well, at night time they would. They were very, very, very stealthy, and they would sneak into the camp at night if you weren't very alert and steal your rifles. And they were so quiet and so good at sneaking around like this. That very often the chaps in the morning, although we'd had guards posted, they would get through, and the chaps would find two or three rifles were missing that these blighters had come in during the night and nicked. So, which didn't please the officers very much. But in spite of the guards, they used to get through because they could crawl along the sand like blooming snakes somehow. Yes.
Had you had any leave at all?
No, we'd had no leave at all. Well, I say no leave. We used to get an odd day's leave now and again to go to Cairo. I forget how often it was. It wasn't very often, but you could apply for a day's leave, I think, and you could be granted it. And we used to go to Cairo. There was a light railway that ran from this place, Wardan. There was nothing else there at all bar this little Bedouin encampment, but this little light railway used to run to Cairo. I forget how many miles it was. It wasn't an awful long way, but anyway, I and two or three pals, we had several trips to Cairo. And I remember one in particular. I always wanted to see the pyramids, and I thought, I'm not coming to Egypt without seeing the pyramids. So on one of these days, we decided that we'd go in to Cairo, and then we would go and visit the pyramids. Well, we got to Cairo, and then we made inquiries, and we found that there was a light railway that ran from Cairo down to the pyramids. It was a more like a tramway with an overhead trolley than a railway. But anyway, we found it in the end, and we all got aboard. I think it was four or five of us. We all got aboard, and then of course they wanted the Egypto conductors wanted the fare, which we hadn't got, or which we said we hadn't got, and we wouldn't get off, so we refused to pay. And eventually, they took us. As a matter of fact, I believe that the troops were allowed to travel on the railway free of charge, I think. But anyway, with some bargaining or something rather, somehow we got to the pyramids eventually on this light railway. It wasn't a long journey, but it finished right out in the desert, quite near to the pyramids, within sight of them anyway. And when we got there, then you had to have a camel to take you to the pyramid, because it was all across sand, and walking across the sand is a bit difficult, so the best thing is to have a camel. Well, we had a camel each. I forget again whether we paid for it or whether we didn't. If we could avoid paying for it, we did. But we got to the pyramids, and then of course we wanted to go inside, and again we had to climb up to an opening, several feet up in the up this pyramid, and there was a square opening. And you had to take your boots and shoes off, so you weren't allowed. But as a matter of fact, it was very slippery inside, and we had to take our boots off and leave them with an Egyptian chap who looked after them for a consideration. Anyway, we went in and clambered all down passages that were shiny with age, and you had to be very careful you didn't slip. And we eventually climbed up to a very big chamber, I think, where the it was called the King's Chamber, where the King's body had been, the sarcophagus, but of course by then it had all been removed and was in the Cairo Museum. But it was an enormous chamber in the centre of the pyramid, and another Egyptian there, he got a magnesium flare that he was very anxious to light to show us the size of the thing. Well, again, we kidded him to light it. He wanted about 5 piastres, I think. But we kidded him to light it in the end, and he showed us, and then we found we hadn't got the 5 piastres. So he cursed us up hill and down dale. But anyway, we saw the chamber. Then we came out. Then we had a bright idea that we wanted to climb up the outside of the pyramid, which was quite an athletic feat, because the blocks of stone of which the pyramids are built were about 6 feet high. And it was something of climbing up there, but we got up there in the end, and we were amazed to find that when we did go up to the top, where we thought it came to a sharp point, it didn't. It was quite a flat expanse at the top. So we had a very thrilling day. Anyway, when we came down again, we